digital security is a really important thing, but I don't think activists are really taking it seriously. We hear a lot about the infiltration of groups by agents in the real world, and in light of all the things that Edward Snowden has released around the NSA and the Prism Network collecting so much information on everybody, why do you think that activists aren't really taking digital security so seriously?
I just think it's part of the general lack of skills with computer technology generally, and we've been very fortunate that the police and authorities have been very slack and not very good at this either, although that's changing very rapidly. They're putting lots of money and investment into digital security from state police, federal police, ASIO. State police have been investing heavily in hacking software, and we can see that they're really upscaling. So we now need to promote within our communities, and we also need to upscale to protect ourselves from that threat.
Sure. So there has been a kind of rising culture over the last couple of years of these things called crypto parties. I remember it must have been about 4 years ago. I went to a crypto party with you, Glenn, in Melbourne, and we're quite nerdy, and even we found it too overwhelming. Why do you think? Is that part of the problem? Do you think that it's just too complicated for people?
4 years ago when we went to that party, it was too complicated, and I also think about 2 years and even 1 year ago is too complicated. A lot has changed, though. We've got people like myself that are translating the geeky stuff to English and normal language for people. But then also technology is progressing. We've got things like Signal, which does encrypted messaging on your phone, which is just easy to install. You just install it like an app. So some of the really complexities in the past, I mean, they're still there, but there's a lot of things that are real quite easy now for normal layperson to do.
Sure. So I noticed on your website, you talked about everyone getting involved in digital security, not just activists, and developing this idea of herd immunity. I wonder if you could unpack that for our listeners a little bit.
Okay. So it's a bit like a concept of they're looking for a needle in a haystack. So if you could just do an X-ray over the whole haystack, it's very easy to find that needle, which is how they're operating at the moment. And if that needle is something that, to say, a peace activist, for example, that's a very bad scenario for us. So if we encrypt every bit of those straws, including our discussions with our mum about our laundry, it means that they can't just easily X-ray that haystack, and that needle becomes very hard to find. So just by everybody in the entire network encrypting our messaging, it means that they then have to go to old-school traditional policing, which is to get a warrant, do an investigation and actually do the police work rather than just automatically scanning the haystack.
Sure. And you touched on Signal there. And a bit later on, let's talk about four things that every activist can do, well, probably every person can do to make their digital life a little more secure. But now, like I wanted to touch on that idea that that everyone needs to do it. There's a program called Tor, which is a browser that basically hides your behaviour online. And that requires more people to be online about it. Would you be able to explain to people a little bit about Tor?
Okay, so Tor works by jumping between lots of different users and encrypting along the way. So it creates such a long message that you cannot reverse engineer that. The actual specific technologies you'll be able to find online. But the concept is the more people that use it, the faster it becomes. So it can be quite slow in Australia. So the more people that start using that, then the faster and more efficient that technology will become. It's a bit like BitTorrent. The more people using BitTorrent, the more efficient and faster it becomes.
And I remember during some of the uprisings during the Arab Spring and the Occupy movement, the Tor network was actually quite fast because there was a lot of people encrypting the work that they were doing.
So a lot of these technologies work by scale. So the more people use them, the more efficient they become.
One thing that you showed me the other day was this website called I Know Where Your Cat Lives. And it really, like, hit for me the fact that there is so much information online and it is really easy to pull all that information and really start to paint a picture of people. A website like that, you know, what sort of level of information do you think is, like, really easily gleaned off someone's phone if they're not encrypting their phone?
Well, it depends if they've got access to the actual phone itself or whether it's your communications. So the I Know Where Your Cat Lives is a site that scrapes photos off the internet and uses the location data and the subject of cats to pinpoint where those cats live as a demonstration of say, how that could apply to children. So most phones, if you've got the settings turned on your camera, will actually give that location settings data in the actual photo itself. So if you're taking photos of your children, for example, and posting them on social media, somebody could actually pull those photos down, find the location, and then find the location of those children, for example. So first step would be to switch off location details off of your images, for example.
Yeah, that's scary stuff, isn't it? And, you know, like Facebook and whatnot, you know, encourages to tag, put the location in and tag the people. I noticed yesterday when I was uploading some photos from the Anarchist Book Fair, which I took with consent as per the Safer Spaces policy. Sorry, side note. But Facebook was asking me to tag people and it was suggesting people. Is that saying that Facebook is using some sort of facial recognition technology in it?
Facebook's one of the world's leading researchers in facial recognition technology. And the interesting thing with Facebook is their business model is not to sell a subscription fee, is that they sell data. So they sell you. So that facial recognition technology is being sold. Who to? Well, it's a private company, so who knows who they're selling it to. So, yeah, when you're tagging your friends, you are actually adding to that data that they sell to other people.
And all this stuff is really scary, but as activists, these tools are really important to us. So there feels like there's this real tension between wanting to do the right thing digitally and join that herd immunity, but also to be able to organise. How do you think we can balance that kind of tension?
It's a really good point because, you know, an ultra-paranoid and technically secure activist is actually going to be less effective because, you know, there's certain tools that such as Facebook that aren't good for organising. So I think it's really a case of using common sense. So learning about the technology and then learning how to use it wisely. So, for example, you may use Facebook to advertise your events and to organise on it, but then you wouldn't use it as a core organising tool and you definitely wouldn't put anything sensitive up there. So, yeah, so it's about, you know, using the technology, but then really being street smart and thinking about how you're using it and what sort of data you're putting on these technologies.
And Facebook's one of those things, isn't it, that even if you're in a secret group or a private message, really that information is not secure at all, is it?
Under law, if the Australian police put a warrant onto that information, then they legally have to give that to them, and they will give them to it. They have a direct relationship with the American intelligence community, so we would assume anything that's on Facebook is accessible by the authorities.
I wanted to start to look at, you have this great list of four things that everyone should be doing to start to communicate more securely online. And I just wanted to slowly go through those things, making sure we get like a little bit of detail about how people can actually implement rather than just talking about these things, which seems to happen a lot. Do you want to go through those four things and then maybe we'll just go through them one by one?
Yeah, so I've got a few things. So maybe we'll just start and then we'll see how much time we've got.
Great.
So the first thing is to install encrypted messaging. So that means that your text messages are encrypted, which means that they can't be spied upon. So Signal, WhatsApp are two trusted ones at the moment. And also you may have heard of Wicca, which Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull was using while implementing the technologies to spy on us. So install one of those three. We recommend Signal. And then start using it. Get your mum to install it. And so when you're talking about the washing, the ASIO will be sitting there getting really worried about what that message is with your mum.
And I remember installing that on my Android phone. It was really easy and really, really quick and easy to install and quick to integrate into your life.
The other next thing is to be smart about your passwords. So start learning about secure passwords. Most people have really easy passwords to crack. And from experience working with hacked websites, it's generally a dodgy password. So start using long and passwords with multiple characters. I mean, if you just Google secure passwords, you'll find that sort of stuff. And we also recommend using password managers. So the problem with that is you're putting all your eggs in one basket. However, it's not humanly possible to remember a lot of secure passwords. So we're recommending that you find password managers such as Dashlane, 1Pass, LastPass, which then puts all your passwords into an encrypted system. So then you have to remember one really long good password and then all of your secure passwords are within that. So it helps you remember all these complex passwords that you're going to need to implement.
Sure. I heard a really good tip around passwords as well was to use things like the first letters of the lyrics of songs to remember. So Mary Had a Little Lamb, M-H-A-L-L. I think that was right. Need to write it down. Or things like that to try and do it rather than using names of people, places where you were born or like to visit, and dates, birth dates as well.
Something your children's name and birth date. So I recommend having long passwords. So 14 characters is far more secure than 12. Mm-hmm. So even if you're writing a sentence out, if you've got a 24, 32-character password, it's far more secure than a random 12-character password.
Yeah, wow.
So you may write yourself a sentence with a few like random stuff in there, and that's a secure password.
So with one question I had around those LastPass and Dashlane kind of password managers, some of them embed themselves within browsers, and so they automatically come up and offer those things. Are they really secure, given that we know that like programs like FinSpy, which is used to spy on activists and used in Australia by the New South Wales Police, actually embeds itself in the updates of things like Mozilla and Chrome and iTunes?
Okay, so to answer that, it's more about understanding that security is not perfect. And there's always a trade-off between convenience and your skill level and security. So what we're talking about today is for beginners to try and get people to the first level or first couple stages of really good security. If you've been hacked and targeted by something like FinSpy, then they're actually logging your keystrokes. So at that point, pretty much anything you do is being hacked. What we're trying to preach is that we secure our systems before those, so that you don't get infected by those sort of things in the first place.
And you're listening to Glenn Todd talking about digital security if you've just tuned in. We're Solidarity Breakfast.
So the next thing I know you had was around encryption, which is one of those things that that turned me off when I first started looking at a digital security stuff. So what is encryption?
Okay, so encryption is just using fancy mathematics to lock data with a password. So it's a lot more complex than that, but that's all we really need to understand. The other thing we need to understand is it secure? And the Snowden leaks has revealed that the US authorities can't crack current encryption. That's not to say that their technology won't change and they may in the future. But generally, even if they can crack it in the future, it's going to take massive computer resources. We're talking about huge supercomputers, long periods of time to crack encryption. So it does work, and even if it stopped working, it's still quite hard for them to crack.
Mm. And there's a few different ways that you can encrypt, isn't there? So you can encrypt your hard drive, you can encrypt your phone, but you can also encrypt folders as well?
Yep. So on a Mac, it's very easy. You just switch encryption on. And I know on Android phone, you just switch it on. So I assume it would be similar in Windows and Linux. Mm-hmm. Now, it's also important to learn how to make encrypted folders on your actual hard drive because they're fundamentally more secure. So, for example, I've got an encrypted folder with my passwords in it, and any sensitive docs you may have, so you would have that encrypted folder and on an encrypted system. And I also recommend that you encrypt all your external hard drives as well. So in a scenario where drives get stolen or are in the wrong hands, then they can't actually access any of that data.
Sure. So I know on Linux, I'm avid Linux user, it's as easy as going into settings and saying encrypt hard drive.
Yep.
it's not hard to find as well. And in Windows, it's very similar as well. And I know for iPhones and Androids, it's really, really easy to do. All it really requires that you've got your phone plugged in at the time when you're doing it. And I think it takes, you know, anywhere between 20 minutes and an hour to do it, but it's definitely worth doing.
Yep. So there's two points there. One is if that data gets in the wrong hand, and they can't access it. But I do want to stress, make sure you've got a backup system in place. If anything goes wrong with the encryption, or if you forget your password, then you will not get your data back. So it's very important. So you may want to write down your fancy new long password that you've just discovered, and you may want to, on paper, and you may want to hide that in a safe location in case you forget your password. And always have backups in place before doing encryption, just in case something goes wrong with the technology, or you misunderstand it yourself and do something wrong, then you make sure you don't lose your data.
Sure. One thing I don't know how to do is to encrypt a folder, which you touched on before. Can you walk us through even how to do that on one platform? Because they're generally quite similar.
Okay, so on a Mac, you go to a folder on your desktop and you right mouse click and choose encrypt folder.
Oh, wow, it's that simple. I feel really, really bad for never doing that before. And I remember you were telling the story of, deniability, like in terms of if you forget passwords and things like that, if you're compelled to give evidence in court. Well, you maybe don't want to talk about that on radio.
Yep, so in court, you legally have to give passwords. So that would be your choice, obviously, with legal advice in that context. However, having random encrypted folders, there's less argument that you know that password. So you're obviously going to know your main password opening a computer, but then it is debatable in a court of law if that random encrypted folder on your hard drive, whether you actually got the password too.
And we all know how easy it is to forget a password.
Yes.
Sure. And the last point we're going to touch on was VPN. I don't even know what VPN stands for.
I think it's a virtual private network, I think. However, the technology, basically what it does is it creates an encrypted channel between your computer and another server on the internet. So generally they're in other countries. So you may have one in the US or one in Switzerland, for example. And so what that does is when you surf on the internet, your internet connection will then be in that country rather than in Australia. So the really important thing about a VPN is it stops all the Australian spy programs, metadata collection that the government's just implemented. Because you're not in Australia, they can't snoop on your data. You're coming from another country. It also means if you want to watch, say, a BBC series and you're not in Britain, you could ping into a VPN that's in Britain, and therefore you're coming on the internet from Britain, so therefore you'll be able to access BBC.
Well, you just added an extra benefit for actually going down and taking that step.
Yeah. In that context, it won't stop any sort of targeted investigation. So if the authorities are watching you specifically, then a VPN will make it a little hard for them, but not much, because they'll just literally follow your VPN connection and find where that's coming out, which is why Tor is a much higher level of security, because it will actually encrypt that channel a few times through different systems. Thing is, Tor can get slow, and a VPN will slow your connection slightly. So if Tor's too slow for you, for your day-to-day activities, you may use the VPN.
Sure, and you can easily search for VPN to find heaps of providers, and I think they start around $10 a month or something like that. Is that right?
I'm paying $7 a month. It's also important to have a look at what companies and who owns those companies are the VPN providers, and maybe have a bit of a search around for ones that are trusted by security geeks.